in order to prevent a genuine popular revolution from taking place in Sudan. And then 2 months later, when people refused to leave the streets, there was a huge massacre. And the people responsible for that have never been brought to justice. And we could very well see another violation, huge violation of human rights in the country as things are developing right now.
Very well. We're going to end it there. Thank you very much. It was fascinating information here. We had Ahmed Caballo at the top of the spotlight, and you were just listening to Abiyomi Azikiwe from Detroit. Thank you, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, and Lawrence Freeman from Baltimore spoke to us, African affairs analyst. And with that, we come to an end for edition of the Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Do join us next time. For Mikabe Tahwe and the entire team, is goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that.
More headlines. Iran blaming the U.S. for instability in Afghanistan. President Raisi says Washington was behind the formation of the Daesh terrorist group there. Protesters in northwest England want to see an Israeli arms company shut down for complicity in war crimes against Palestinians. And in Brazil, a Senate committee is demanding that President Bolsonaro face criminal charges for his reckless leadership of the COVID pandemic. Hello and welcome to your World News, coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Top story this hour, a conference of Afghan neighbors is starting in Tehran. The foreign ministers of six neighboring states, plus Russia, attending the event. In comments made just ahead of the conference, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said there is a single country that should chiefly take the blame for the current instability and insecurity in Afghanistan, and that is the United States. Recalling how Daesh terrorists have been harming security after the withdrawal of U.S. troops, Raisi said Washington is responsible because it initially helped create the terror group. The foreign ministers of Pakistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan are present in Tehran for the event. The top diplomats of Russia and China attending online. The Taliban will not be represented. Tehran says the goal of the conference is to reject foreign interference in Afghanistan's future political structure and to pledge support for the Afghan people. Now, political commentator Lawrence Davidson believes the conference regional countries are set to hold about the crises in Afghanistan will prove more effective than any solution put forth by the U.S.
Well, it seems to me that the meeting that the Iranians are now hosting is a much more far-reaching and far-seeing and humane sort of approach to this situation than anything the Americans can put together. The approach of governments in this sort of situation is identical with taking things out on the people, okay? I mean, they might put specific kinds of sanctions on leaders, specific leaders and that kind of stuff. But if you're going to boycott these countries or prevent the import of medicines and this sort of thing, you know, you've got to hurt the people. And we realize that from what's been going on in Iraq and was going on in Iraq and Yemen and all that the American government is perfectly willing to do that.
The UN says millions of Afghans, including children, could die of starvation unless urgent action is taken to pull the country from or back from the brink of collapse. The world body has called for frozen funds to be free to boost humanitarian efforts. Here's more.
The United Nations has warned that more than half of Afghanistan's 39 million population is facing acute food insecurity as hunger is rising and children are dying. We can't feed people on promises, says the head of the World Food Program, David Beasley. He has urged world countries to step up life-saving assistance to resuscitate Afghanistan's economy.
We have been left on the streets for 3 months now. We haven't received any aid despite calls on the United Nations. Most women and children are sick or starving. Why are they doing this to us? Aren't we human beings?
Nowadays, there are no jobs for us, but there is poverty, hunger, and disaster. We are a family of 10 and wondering what to do and how to feed them. Winter is closing in and prices are rising. People will die if the government and other countries don't take any action.
Here, Afghan social activists have come together on behalf of millions of vulnerable people and families to protest the critical humanitarian situation in the country. They're calling on the U.S. to free Afghans' assets and compensate them for its war crimes in Afghanistan.
We are chanting for our rights. The U.S. has always treated Afghans with cruelty. Our protest today has two aims. First, we are calling on the U.S. to free up our own money and let aid flow in. Second, the U.S. must compensate us for the war crimes it has committed and the damage it has caused.
The Taliban takeover weakened an already fragile economy that was heavily dependent on foreign aid. Western countries suspended aid, and the World Bank and International Monetary Fund also halted payments. Immediate global aid is now crucial to meet the most basic humanitarian needs of Afghans as winter approaches with no jobs, cash, or prospects for the people. Afghans and humanitarian bodies have warned of imminent disaster if proper action is not taken. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iraqi security officials say nearly a dozen people have been killed in an attack in the eastern province of Diyala. The deaths occurred when gunmen armed with automatic weapons stormed the village of Hawasha near the town of Mehdadiya. At least 15 people sustained injuries in the shooting spree. Iraq's Joint Operations Command said civilians were the target of the attack. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the incident, but Iraqi security officials blamed the bloodshed on the Daesh terror group. The Iraqi president has condemned the attack as a cowardly act aimed at destabilizing the country. The prime minister also promised to hold the perpetrators to account. Yemen's Supreme Political Council has condemned what it called the UN inaction over Saudi crimes in Yemen. The council has called on the UN to end its support for the former government of Abdurrabba Mansour Hadi, saying it does not represent the interests of the Yemeni people. Abdulatif Al-Washili reports from Sana'a.
President of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, has sent a certain message to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, slamming the world body's inaction regarding Saudi Arabia's bloody war on Yemen.
Unfortunately, Saudi money has weakened the role of the United Nations in Yemen and has changed the world body's political position. The United Nations' primary concern should be the humanitarian situation in Yemen, but it has failed to consider that.
In the message sent to Antonio Guterres on United Nations Day, Mashat called on the UN to stop manipulating the facts in Yemen for political ends. He said the world body has effectively covered up for Saudis during 7 years of war under blockade. He added that the UN failure to renew the mandate of the Human Rights Council's group of eminent experts is yet another proof of how Saudis are bribing their way through the world body.
It was not so much a message of congratulation as it was a message of blame for the UN's negative role regarding what the Yemeni people have been subjected to over the past 7 years. It's a clear message that the UN must play its role and that the international community has failed morally in Yemen. We are ready to support the continued work of the United Nations and its humanitarian organizations and facilitate their operations inside Yemen, but on the condition that the United Nations protects the Yemeni people and stops Saudi violations.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen on March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people, including women and children, and has pushed the country to the brink of famine. Yemenis say the United Nations continues to apply double standards when dealing with the ongoing Saudi crimes against millions of Yemenis. They believe that the Yemeni army's operations are legitimate as it is defending the sovereignty of Yemen, which is the only way forward to put an end to the humanitarian crisis in the country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The United States has expressed concern over Israel's decision to build 1,300 new settler units in the occupied West Bank.
We strongly oppose the expansion of settlements, which is completely inconsistent with efforts to lower tensions and to ensure calm, and it damages the prospects for a two-state solution.
Ned Price also said the U.S. views as unacceptable the regime's plans for legalization of illegal outposts. The criticism followed a similar statement from the European Union. Israel announced the plan on Friday. That is why all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal under international law as they are built on occupied Palestinian land. The UN Security Council, in several resolutions, has called for a halt to Israel's settlement activities. Commentator Paul Lurie says Washington's apparent disapproval of Israel's plans to build more settlements in the occupied West Bank is anything but sincere and will not cost the regime anything.
The United States, under Biden, wants to show some degree of independence from Israel, trying to differentiate itself from the Trump regime, which never criticized Israel, and it's trying to show some unanimity with the European Union. But Israel, in fact, is running things, and the only thing the United States is doing is registering a complaint, disapproval, if you will. It's not as if it's going to make Israel pay a price for this. Not at all.
The UK is home to some of the world's biggest weapons manufacturers, among them Israel's Elbit Systems. Said Purezo has traveled to one of the company's factories in northwest England that's facing growing calls to close up shop.
They're small in number, but they have big voices resonating along the streets of Oldham, Manchester, calling for Israeli arms company Elbit Systems to be shut down.
This is the Elbit site in Manchester, and the event here, organized by several pro-Palestinian groups who accuse Elbit of providing Israel with predatory drones and other military hardware, accusing it of complicity in Israeli war crimes and in abetting Israel in terrorizing the people of Gaza.
Elbit Systems UK, a subsidiary of the Israel-based company of the same name, employs over 500 people and has 10 sites in the UK, including four factories.
Israel is an apartheid state. It's a racist state which is preventing Palestinians from living their ordinary everyday lives. And indeed worse, it's starving them, it's bombing them, it's killing them, it's depriving them of their lands and homes. And it has been since 1948. This factory here, Elbit, is the largest private Israeli arms factory. There's 10 outlets in the UK, and they are all making drones and weapons which go to kill Palestinians.
Apart from supplying Israel with weaponry, Elbit is also a major supplier of sophisticated technology to the British military.
That Britain and Israel have a clear, incestuous, revolving door type of relationship between each of their military establishments and their arms companies. We are fighting back against that here.
In August, pro-Palestine activists took their fight to another level. Direct action against the same site in Oldham, causing disruption to the firm's operations. For their actions, they often face intimidation, arrest, and possible prison time. But they say they're unfazed.
The Palestinian people are losing their lives. What's jail? What is a court? I already know that what I'm doing is right. I'm already on the right side of history. If I end up in court, I don't need some judge to tell me whether I've done the right thing or the wrong thing. If I go to jail trying to save the lives of the Palestinian people, so be it.
Events such as the one today have led to increased public awareness about Elbit and its operations and growing calls for its closure. That, the activists say, is one important step towards a free Palestine. Saeed Puriza, London.
COVID outbreaks are seeing an uptick in some European countries. Just in the past week, over 40 countries in the region have had an increase in the number of infections. Now the latest figures coming out of Bulgaria show more than 6,800 new daily infections, the highest since the beginning of the pandemic. Also, more than 120 new fatalities, now bringing the overall toll to over 23,400. Bulgaria is facing medical staff shortages, and hospitals are overwhelmed with COVID patients. The country has the lowest vaccination rate in the EU. Elsewhere, Germany's daily deaths going into the triple digits again, with over 110 deaths. And there have been more than 23,000 new infections there. In Brazil, a Senate investigative committee recommends Jair Bolsonaro face criminal charges for his controversial handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. The panel also called on Brazil's Supreme Court to suspend the president's access to his social media accounts for citing false information about COVID-19. However, Bolsonaro rejects the accusations, saying he is guilty of nothing. The Senate committee is also calling for the indictment of 77 other people, including several ministers and Bolsonaro's sons, who are accused of spreading misinformation. More than 600,000 Brazilians have lost their lives since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. In Ecuador, security forces have clashed with demonstrators protesting against soaring fuel prices. In the capital, Quito, police used tear gas to disperse the crowd. Countrywide, thousands of protesters hit the streets on Tuesday, blocking roads and disrupting traffic in several provinces. The office of President Guillermo Lasso says at least 18 arrests were made. The rallies were organized by the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador. The South American nation is facing an economic collapse worsened by the coronavirus pandemic, popular discontent with the government, widespread gang violence, and corruption allegations against officials. In a rare rebuke of U.S. foreign policy, the U.N. envoy on human rights in North Korea has called for an end to the country's isolation. That has been echoed by ordinary citizens in South Korea, too. The development comes amid rifts between the U.S. and South Korea over their policy toward Pyongyang. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
The sanctions by the United Nations Security Council against North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs have been in place for more than a decade. The UN now acknowledges that the U.S.-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
DPR Korea has never been more isolated from the international community than at this point in time. This is having a dramatic impact on the human rights of the people inside of the country and dampens hopes of achieving sustainable peace and security on the Korean Peninsula.
The special rapporteur was echoing and backed the call by some member states for sanctions relief for North Korea.
There must be a move back towards the spirit of multilateral cooperation that enabled the foundation of the United Nations in the first place.
This weekend, the South Korean and U.S. envoys on North Korea met in Seoul, with South Korea calling for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, and the U.S. agreeing to discuss the proposal later. The U.S. has often repeated that it's willing to meet with North Korea anywhere, anytime, without preconditions. U.S. officials have now added that the country holds no hostile intent toward North Korea, while at the same time pressing for stronger implementation of the controversial United Nations Security Council sanctions. South Koreans expressed their hope the international community could at least provide humanitarian aid. South Korean President Moon Jae-in has sought to build peace with North Korea, arranging summits and proposing other avenues of engagement, while the U.S. maintained a hard line. President Moon will leave office next spring. Frank Smith, Seoul.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Limelight. Nearly 700 European firms have financial ties worth $255 billion with businesses actively involved in illegal Israeli settlements, according to a new report from civil society. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Boxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading Report Reveals European Firms Have More Than $255 Billion Entwined in Illegal Israeli Settlements. Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. Wilhelm Stays, coordinator of DBIO Coalition, noted, despite the illegal nature of Israeli regime settlements under international law, European financial institutions continue to throw a financial lifeline to companies operating in the settlements. European financial institutions should take up their responsibility and follow the example of KLP and GPFG. they should end all investments and financial flows into Israeli settlements and not buy into Israeli regime occupation. Even with these divestment decisions, however, the aforementioned firms still associate with settlement-entwined businesses. KLP is invested in 8 companies involved in a settlement enterprise: Delta Galil Industries, FIBI, Matrix IT, Mavin Group, Rami Levy Chain Stores, Hashikma Marketing 2006, Shapir Engineering and Industry, and Shafaral. GPFG still has business dealings with 34 companies linked to the illegal Israeli settlements. These businesses are ACS Group, Atlas, Copco, Bank Hapoalim, and Bank Leumi. These ongoing financial relationships put into question the firm's commitment to human rights. Maha Abdullah, one of the co-drafters of the report and the International Advocacy Officer at Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies, told MinPress News that the DBIO's findings definitely contradict the institution's purported ethical responsibilities. Abdullah said, "These companies and financial institutions claim that they are committed to human rights, but then we see the facts on the ground and the level of their involvement in the settlement. So, clearly, these are all in violation of their responsibilities under international law and towards human rights standards." Al-Haq's Khazir speculated, however, that the slow pullout from the settlement enterprise may stem from fears of political backlash. "We saw how the reaction from the Israeli regime towards Ben & Jerry's decision was," Khazir said, adding, "so some companies would be wary of reputational risk and also see divestment as problematic for their shareholders. It's a process of finding the right balance in terms of their gains and their goals." All 50 companies named in the report participate in at least one of the activities listed by the United Nations as criteria for inclusion in its database of companies operating in the illegal Israeli settlements. Of the 50 companies implicated, 15 are American. These businesses are Airbnb, Booking Holdings, Caterpillar, CETCO Mineral Technology Group, Cisco Systems, CNH Industrial, DXC Technology, Energix, Expedia, etc. More than 600,000 Israelis live in settlements across OPT, and 42% of the West Bank is under settlement control. Area C of the West Bank abounds with natural resources, but 68% of this region is reserved for illegal Israeli settlements, while only 1% is designated for Palestinian use. The continuous settler takeover of Palestinian land has prevented Palestinians from developing and utilizing their resources and therefore significantly depleted their economy. Restricted access to Dead Sea, quarries, and mines has led to an over $1 billion annual loss in revenue for Palestine, according to a 2015 policy brief from Palestinian think tank Al Shabaka. And companies' exploitation of West Bank quarries is estimated at $900 million annually. The DBIO report authors write, "The exploitation of natural resources means that The Palestinian people are denied their right to self-determination and permanent sovereignty over their natural resources. By profiting from the depletion of Palestinian finite quarry resources, individual corporate actors may be held criminally liable for complicity in the crimes of appropriation, environmental destruction, and the pillage of natural resources. The EU provided more than $40 million in humanitarian aid to Palestine in 2021. It also follows international law in declaring the Israeli settlements illegal. Yet the EU is the Zionist regime's largest trade partner, with a total of approximately $36 billion in traded goods last year. Hodair said, explaining that the goals of foreign affairs units often clash with human rights entities in the EU. There are conflicting interests even between different European institutions, each with their own priorities. The EU does not support the UN database on companies complicit in the illegal Israeli settlements and continues to block funding to update the resource over budgetary constraints. Yet again, in contradictory fashion, an EU court also ruled in 2019 that consumers have a right to know if products sold in EU markets were made in illegal Israeli settlements. Abdullah said, on the one hand, the EU has a very consistent approach and position on the illegality of settlements and all the associated violations that come along with it that undermine Palestinian rights. But at the same time, we are seeing that European businesses and financial institutions are still freely and without any consequences are being involved and active with the settlement enterprise. For Abdullah, European business activity in the settlement seems in a strong contrast to the EU's stated allegiances to the Palestinian cause. Abdullah said, "We know what that means in reality. It means giving them an economic lifeline, allowing them to sustain themselves and expand and grow with time, because these settlements, at the end of the day, rely on money in order to prosper and sustain and expand."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Hunger strike is a protest method. Those who go on a hunger strike refuse food or drink. People use hunger strikes when they have no other way of protesting. Prisoners usually do this to protest their detention conditions, call for a change in a policy, or bring attention to a specific matter. By drawing international attention to the plight of prisoners, they aim to put pressure on their jailers and spur a change in policy. That's what Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails have been doing. For decades, thousands of Palestinian inmates have gone under hunger strikes to protest their situation. The administrative detention and the fact that the Israeli regime has no right to hold them without any specific reason.
Asfar Hiba, she was arrested on August 15th at the Kerama border crossing where she was on her way from Jordan to the West Bank. She was held and interrogated at an intelligence center, being denied any liars. The commission's lawyer visited her 2 days ago, and in her report, she said Hiba's lost around 10 kilograms. She's been isolated, abused, assaulted, and held in brutal conditions. She informed the lawyer she won't end the hunger strike as long as she's held under administrative detention.
Israeli occupation is primarily responsible for the life of Maher al-Akhras because after more than 70 days of a hunger strike, he suffered serious weight loss and he repeatedly loses consciousness. His heart could suddenly stop. Today he's in a serious health condition. This requires immediate intervention from all sides to reach a solution to save his life.
Under international law, Israel is responsible for the well-being of all persons in its custody. So hunger strikes can be used to pressure the occupying regime. Earlier this month, a mass hunger strike was staged across Israeli jails. Up to 400 Palestinian inmates went on a hunger strike. Just in September, another 1,400 Palestinian prisoners launched a hunger strike. Both hunger strikes were in reaction to the punitive measures imposed on Palestinian inmates following the escape of six Palestinians from Gilboa prison last month. It all started on September 6th when Israeli jail authorities realized that six inmates had escaped the maximum security jail through a tunnel. The jailbreak made a mockery of Israeli authorities. Although all six escapees were captured, the fact that they carried out such an operation right under the nose of prison guards made it quite embarrassing. So in response, the Israeli prison service cracked down particularly hard on prisoners belonging to the Islamic Jihad, to which five of the escapees belong. The Israelis transferred several prisoners belonging to the Islamic Jihad to solitary confinement, and leaders of the movement were transferred to interrogation cells. The conditions the prisoners were living under were so harsh, they decided to stage a hunger strike. In a statement, the prisoners said the strike is a rebellion and rejection of prison administration laws. Since 1968, Palestinians have been launching mass and individual hunger strikes after Israel occupied the remaining Palestinian territories of the West Bank, Jerusalem al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip. The first strike was on February 18, 1969, in Ramle prison. The prisoners protested meager portions and poor quality food, as well as the policy of banning writing stationery and being forced to address their jailers as sir. The strike ended when prison authorities put the prisoners in solitary confinement. In July 1970, Abdul Ghader Abu Al-Fahm became the first Palestinian prisoner to die during a hunger strike. Al-Fahm died because of force feeding by Israeli prison authorities, who inserted a nasal feeding tube into his lungs instead of his stomach. Israel constantly uses this method of force feeding prisoners on hunger strike. The United Nations Committee Against Torture has called on Israel to ensure that prisoners on hunger strike are not subjected to force feeding or other medical treatment against their will, as it could amount to torture. The world body also said the practice under no circumstances will comply with human rights standards. A hunger strike in September 1984 is considered a turning point in the history of hunger strikes. 800 prisoners reportedly joined the strike for better conditions in the Nablus prison. Prisoners were crammed into overcrowded cells, suffering from a lack of ventilation and no reading material. The strike brought about many changes, such as bringing in a radio, TV, clothes, and better quality food. In 1992, one of the most successful hunger strikes across Israeli jails occurred. 7,000 prisoners joined the movement. The strike resulted in major achievements, such as shutting down the prison's isolation section, stopping strip searches, increasing family visitation time, and allowing cooking slates in the cells. Mikhdad Qawasme is the latest individual who has staged a hunger strike against his administrative detention. The last time the 24-year-old was on the news, he was in an intensive care unit after 91 days of strikes. It's often said that hunger strikes are a non-violent form of protest, but by refusing food and drink, protesters put their lives in danger. They risk permanent damage to their health and eventually death. Even after a protester decided to end a hunger strike, there is the potential risk of refeeding syndrome. This syndrome occurs because of the shifts in fluids and electrolytes, meaning that giving too much food or fluids too quickly may be dangerous and potentially fatal. It may include liver dysfunction, heart arrhythmia, and pulmonary, neurological, or other symptoms. There are cases in which hunger strikes can amount to torture as well. There are currently 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, including 35 women and 200 children. All these hunger strikes are just last desperate calls for help from Palestinian prisoners. Will the international community finally do something serious for them?
Britain's National Health Service could soon be unable to deliver the care it needs to for women giving birth if the surge in COVID cases continues, the president of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has said. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's health editor, Andrew Gregory. The piece is titled, NHS Maternity Services Near Breaking Point, Warns Top Doctor. The National Health Service could soon be unable to deliver the care it needs to for women giving birth if the surge in COVID cases continues, the president of Britain's Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has said. Dr. Edward Morris, Britain's most senior gynecologist, became the latest high-ranking clinician to raise the alarm about the increasing pressure on the National Health Service. As COVID cases rise and it battles a huge backlog of 5.7 million patients caused by the first and the second wave of the virus. He told The Guardian he was increasingly concerned about the immense pressures facing maternity staff. The latest figures suggest the sharp rise in new cases reported in recent weeks is now having an impact on hospital numbers, with average daily COVID hospital admissions in England at their highest level for nearly 8 months. The latest data shows 39,962 people reporting testing positive for COVID on Sunday, with 328,287 testing positive in the last 7 days, and 949 deaths during the same period. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, on Sunday, 24th of October, publicly ruled out immediately moving to the government's coronavirus Plan B. A suite of light-touch measures, such as working from home and compulsory face masks in some settings. The Chancellor said the data did not suggest such a move was necessary, despite reports that Britain's Health Security Agency, UKHSA, was canvassing the level of support among local authorities for the immediate rollout of the winter plan, the clearest sign yet that Whitehall is actively considering additional measures. Dr. Edward Morris said the surge in COVID infections also threatened to derail efforts to tackle a huge backlog in cases of women waiting for gynecological treatment. Senior doctors say operations are already being cancelled in some parts of the country. President of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, Dr. Edward Morris, raised fears patient safety could be put at risk in maternity wards if the increase in COVID cases and hospitalizations resulted in specialist staff being redeployed to other parts of hospitals, as happened in the first coronavirus wave. The COVID-19 pandemic is far from over, and we're becoming increasingly concerned about the immense pressure facing our maternity staff this winter if the situation continues as it is, he said. We're also aware of the many women and girls who are suffering with gynecological conditions that are currently on extensive waiting lists with no end in sight. With the number of COVID-19 cases rising once more, the National Health Service could soon be in a situation where it is unable to deliver the care it needs to or deal with the huge backlog that has already built up. Dr. Morris added, we know during the first wave of the pandemic, maternity staff were redeployed to different areas of the hospital, and we would urge NHS trusts and boards to avoid this at all costs. Maternity staff could not be replaced by other staff groups due to their specialist skill set, he said. And protecting this workforce was crucial to ensuring that safe maternity care can be sustained. Dr. Edward Morris urged unvaccinated pregnant women to urgently get jabbed. Figures show almost a fifth of the most critically ill coronavirus patients in England in recent months were unvaccinated pregnant women. We're seeing higher numbers of pregnant women in critical care than at any other point during the pandemic, and the vast majority of these women are sadly unvaccinated. Vaccination against COVID-19 and flu is the best way for pregnant women to protect themselves and their baby this winter. Both Labour and the Liberal Democrats have called for some Plan B measures to be introduced, and the National Health Service Confederation on Wednesday became the first major organisation to warn that rising cases risk derailing efforts to tackle the backlog. On Sunday, 24th of October, Rishi Sunak announced funding worth almost £6 billion aimed at tackling waiting lists. In an effort to get a grip on the crisis, the Chancellor unveiled plans for investment in the National Health Service capital funding to help deliver about 30% more elective activity by 2024-2025, compared with pre-pandemic levels. This is equivalent to millions more checks, scans, and procedures for non-emergency patients. Dr. Catherine Henderson, the president of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, warned on Sunday, 24th of October, that emergency departments were in a terrible place. She told Sky News' Trevor Phillips on Sunday, we're already struggling to cope. This is not something that's coming in the next couple of months. We're already in a terrible place where we have got large queues of ambulances with vulnerable people waiting in those ambulances to be offloaded into departments and other patients at home waiting to be picked up by the ambulance. That's the thing that's really worrying me, that these are patients who have not yet received treatment, that we don't necessarily know what's wrong with them, and we're really struggling to get into our healthcare facilities to then work out what we need to do. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has previously said vaccines will get the country through the winter and out of the pandemic. But on Sunday, Professor Adam Finn, who is a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization, said the vaccine program would not be enough to bring infection rates under control. Professor Adam Finn said, People should be testing themselves, wearing face masks and avoiding crowds in enclosed spaces in order to prevent a real meltdown in what he described as a worsening situation. While vaccines were very effective at stopping people from getting seriously ill, he said, they were not so effective at stopping infections altogether or stopping the virus spreading. They do have an effect on that, but they're not by themselves going to be enough at the present time to keep the spread of the coronavirus under control, he told Sky News' Trevor Phillips. I would like to re-emphasize the fact that the vaccine program by itself in the current situation, even if things go optimally, is not, in my opinion, enough to bring things under control.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have the honor and absolute privilege of being joined by my darling friend and dear sister, Sister Razia Shamani. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. How are you, my dear Zainab?
Alhamdulillah, I'm very well and even better. But I'm in the studio with you.
Alhamdulillah, the same here, the same feeling.
Because you just exude so much energy and you constantly put things that I perhaps maybe knew before into a new perspective. And I'm like, oh, I never thought of that before. And it just changes my life.
Thank you very much for your beautiful comments.
So today, I believe we're going to discuss something that is rarely talked about, in all honesty. And what better platform, what better show to discuss it than Muslim Lady? We're going to be talking about perhaps the vague historical details surrounding the daughters of the Noble Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. How many were they? Because there's like so much dispute on that.
How many children he had in general?
In general, exactly. How many of them were girls? Around which years were they born? How did they, or when did they pass away? How long did they live? How was their life as the daughters of the most prominent and important human being in the history of the world?
Right. There are a lot of disputes as in like how many daughters did the Prophet have, how many actually children he had, and how many were from him and Lady Khadija, how many, you know, were from Lady Khadija from previous marriages. Like, there is no certain answer for that. But you can say that according to historical accounts, the noble prophet had four daughters and three sons, meaning
four
seven
daughters and three sons,
seven
okay.
children. Mm-hmm. And out of these seven children, six of them were from Lady Khadija and Prophet Muhammad, and one son called Abraham
was from
Maria Ghatia, right. And all of the children of Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, they died during the lifespan of the noble prophet, except Lady Fatima.
That's so sad.
Who passed away shortly after her father's demise, right? So his bloodline obviously continued through Lady Fatima, as also there are beautiful stories, historical stories, even surahs, chapters in the Quran, where relatives of the Holy Prophet and some other disbelievers, unbelievers, were accusing the Prophet that you're going to be abtar, you're going to be without any bloodline, you're going to be like without any descendants. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala descended Surah Kawthar. Inna a'taynaka al-kawthar. Fasalli li rabbika wanhar inna shani'aka huwa al-abtar. Saying that we have given you abundant blessing.
Abundant blessing.
Which many interpret to be, Shiite and Sunni scholars interpret to be Lady Fatima. Salamullah alayha, right?
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. Indeed, we have granted you, O Muhammad, Al-Kawthar. So pray to your Lord and sacrifice to him alone. Indeed, your enemy is the one cut off.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to Muslim Lady here in the studio. I'm with my darling sister Razia Shamili, and we're talking about the historical details behind the life of the numerous daughters of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
What were the names of Prophet Muhammad's daughters? The names are Ruqayya, Zainab, Umm Kulthum, and Fatima.
Okay.
Now, Ruqayya, she was born before the migration of the... You know, there aren't, like, exact dates as to when they were born, but approximately we know that Ruqayya was born before the Prophet migrated to the city of Medina.
Okay.
So that's for Ruqayya. And who did she marry? She married Utba ibn Abu Lahab.
No way.
Her cousin, right? Abu Lahab.
Her father's cousin.
Right. Her father's cousin. She married him, but... He divorced her because when, you know, after the noble prophet became the prophet, he was appointed as the prophet, Abu Lahab made his son to divorce
his
daughter-in-law,
yeah.
right? Because they were, like, related to the prophet. So then she married Uthman bin Affan, right? These are what you see in historical accounts.
Okay.
Right? And then...
Uthman being the third caliph.
The interesting thing about Ruqayya was that she was present in the migration to Ethiopia and Medina. So in the two migrations, Ruqayya was one of those active ladies, active women, who, you know, because of the very difficult situation of the Muslims and the advent of Islam, you know, many of them, they traveled to Ethiopia because the ruler was a Christian, a very wise and good-hearted man.
And so he was welcoming of the Muslims.
Exactly. Mm. So the daughter of the Prophet, was among the Muhajirin to Ethiopia and then to the city of Medina. Unfortunately, Ruqayyah died in the year 2 after Hijra. So 2 years after her migration to the city of Medina, she passed away, and guess where she is buried?
Baqi.
So this time you go to Baqi, you probably know that that one of the daughters of the Prophet is also buried in Baqi Cemetery. Now, the next daughter is Zainab.
Right.
We're not talking about the granddaughter of the Prophet, but we're talking about Lady Zainab, who is the daughter of the Prophet. She was born, some historians say that Zainab was Prophet Muhammad's eldest daughter.
All right.
So she was like the first daughter born. And she was, about her date of birth, it's interesting that it's cited that she was born in the year 30 Amul Fil, 30 years after the attack of Abraha to the city of Kaaba, Zainab was born.
So basically, when Rasulullah was 30 years old, almost 5 years after his marriage with Sayyidah Khadija. Okay.
She passed away in the year 8 after Hijra.
8 after Hijra, right?
So 8 years. Her sister, she passed away 2 years after Hijra. She passed away 8 years after Hijra. And was buried again in which
Baqiyah,
place?
Baqi
Cemetery, right, in the city of Medina. Now, the third daughter is called Umm Kulthum.
Uh-huh.